WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
With me now on Fresh Air is James Lincoln Collier, author of a new critical biography titled Louis Armstrong, an American Genius. In his opening chapter, Collier writes, quote, "From a number of viewpoints, Armstrong is the archetypical 20th century figure. First, he was an American during a period when the world was looking to the United States as a source of new ideas, new ways of thinking and doing things. Second, he was black at a time when one of the most important international political movements was the struggle of blacks for parity in the world. Finally, during a century in which personal expression has been both a philosophy of life and a leading principle of art, Armstrong was the creative genius who first demonstrated the possibilities inherent in improvised music," unquote. We're going to discuss Armstrong's life and music and listen to some of his recordings. James Lincoln Collier is also the author of the book The Making of Jazz. His articles have appeared in the New York Times Magazine, The Wall Street Journal, and The Village Voice. His new book, Louis Armstrong, an American Genius, is published by Oxford, and I want to welcome you to Fresh Air.
Well, Terry, I'm very happy to be here.
People have been introduced to Armstrong's music in a number of ways. For me, it was on the Ed Sullivan Show, seeing him do songs like Mack the Knife and Hello Dolly, mopping his brow with his handkerchief in ways that comedians still imitate him. And it took me many years after that to learn Armstrong's earlier music, which is what got me to really appreciate his work. What was your introduction to Armstrong?
Well, your introduction was, of course, typical. I think most people today think of Armstrong as the happy-go-lucky entertainer that he so often was, in fact, made a practice of being. But I had got interested in Armstrong during the early 1940s when I was 12 years old, more or less. At that time, there was a kind of reviving interest in some of the older jazz forms, and there were a lot of reissue programs going on, and not to the extent that we have them today, but they were still going on. And, of course, here came a set of records from Columbia, Louis Armstrong and his Hot Five, and I got them, and not really knowing what to expect, and I was absolutely bowled over by them. I must say, it did take me a little while to come to understand them, you know, all in their full depth. But I've been listening to Armstrong's records, you know, right, well, that's a long time ago.
Armstrong has been one of the most important figures in the development of jazz. Let's go back to the beginning of his musical development when he was in New Orleans. What was the music scene like in New Orleans when he was first starting to play?
Well, New Orleans has always been a very musical city. Going back as far as you want to go, they have had a tradition of music down there, in part because they were that early French tradition coming out of the French courts of the 18th century, where it was music and dance and wine, women and song, that kind of thing. So Louis was hearing a lot of music, but he was particularly hearing the music that was being made by blacks at that time, which was ragtime, march music, the blues, and this kind of incipient jazz that was just beginning to sort of coagulate out of the blues and the rags that were at that time one of the most important facets of American popular music. Louis was raised in a brothel neighborhood. It's not understood, really, that the famous and highly romanticized Storyville was, in fact, two Storyvilles. There was a white Storyville and a black Storyville. Louis was raised in the black Storyville for the very good reason that his mother was working there. And he grew up hearing the blues seeping out of those honky-tonks, which were on every corner, sometimes four facing each other on the corners. And so he was absorbing that early jazz and the blues just through his pores from the time he was very little.
Why was New Orleans such a fertile place for the development of jazz?
That's a question that I've struggled to answer a great many times. I have a feeling, and this is only a hunch, based on a good deal of research, that the blues has a much shorter history than we think, and that there is a good chance that the blues existed in New Orleans before they did a lot of other places. You also had a group down there called the Black Creoles. It was a subculture, French-speaking blacks, who had been disenfranchised and were being pushed down among the mainstream blacks, who were, of course, day laborers at the very bottom of the social heap. And these people had a kind of tradition of music and dance, which may have contributed something to it, too. But it's a very difficult question. I've spent a lot of time trying to untangle that. the particular roots of jazz, and those are about the best guesses I can come up with. You did have the blues there, you did have ragtime, you did have a lot of music, and you did have the Creoles, who some of whom, like Sidney Bechet and Jelly Roll Morton, proved to be very formative figures in the music.
Well, speaking of Sidney Bechet, that you have brought a record with you which features Bechet and Armstrong from the mid-1920s.
This record was made in 1924 in New York after Bechet and Armstrong had left New Orleans under the leadership of Clarence Williams, who made a lot of those early records. But it reflects as closely as anything the way the blues were played in the honky-tonks for the Hustlers to dance a slow drag tune. It's called Texas Moaner Blues.
Let's hear it. We just heard the Texas Moaner Blues recorded in 1923 with Louis Armstrong and Sidney Bechet. My guest is James Lincoln Collier, author of a new critical biography of Armstrong titled Louis Armstrong, an American Genius. Well, we've been talking about Armstrong in New Orleans. He moved to Chicago in 1922. Was the style that he was playing in from New Orleans similar to what the Chicago musicians were playing?
Well, what had happened was there had developed some taste for jazz by people who had gone down to New Orleans and had heard it down there. It did not really exist anyplace else. It really did come from New Orleans, as the old legend says. But gradually, by the time of the end of the First War, 1917, 1918, a lot of the New Orleans players were going north because they realized they could make more money. They were going to be treated better up there. They weren't being treated by any manner of means properly, but they were being treated better than they were in the South. So they had begun to move out. And one of the ones who had gone up was King Oliver, who went up there in about 1918 to play in a band which eventually was called the Creole Jazz Band, which became one of the famous early jazz bands. And Oliver asked Louis to come up. So Louis was playing in a New Orleans context. These were New Orleans bands, and they excited the musicians in Chicago. The black and the white musicians were very, very drawn to this music. Oliver was playing at a place called Lincoln Gardens, which was essentially a black dance hall. In fact, most of the clubs that these people were playing in were black and tans, where they would have mixed audiences. But Lincoln Gardens was black, and so great was the interest among white musicians that on Wednesdays at 11 o'clock, the band, the King Oliver Band with Louis Armstrong, would go off the stand, the blacks would be cleared out, and at 12 o'clock, the band would come back on, and the white musicians, and many of them top players in popular music, would come down and sit and drink and listen to the Oliver Band play for hours. It was known as a midnight ramble, went on every Wednesday. Louis and those, well, at that point, not so much Louis, but the whole New Orleans jazz style was just tremendously attractive to the other players.
What was it like in the nightclubs at that period in Chicago? The mobsters, I think, had a lot to do with their with their money, I guess.
Well, the mobs,
because it was controlled a lot by the mobs.
Terry, the mobs ran everything. They were running the whole city of Chicago. They had the mayor in their pocket. They were doing what they wanted. They could murder with impunity, which they did constantly. They had their own hospitals where they would go when they got shot up and no questions asked. And they ran the clubs. And it was on the south side of Chicago, particularly in the Black Belt area of the south side, that these black and tan clubs were developing. Some of them were quite fancy. The Sunset Cafe, the Savoy, the Dreamland, mirrors, lights, faceted light bulbs. And they put on very elaborate shows. They'd have two or three chorus lines. They'd have dancers. They'd have comics. And it was a great thing for white audiences to go down there and drink and watch these shows and hear some of the great early jazz musicians.
Armstrong had his first real successes in Chicago. He started recording with the Hot Five, and those records, you write, much to his surprise, became very popular around the country. Why don't we listen to one of those recordings and then talk about the results of that success on his career?
Well, good. I think if we listen to anything, we have to listen to Louis Armstrong's West End Blues. It absolutely stunned the other musicians and has subsequently been considered by many to be possibly the single most important jazz record ever made.
Okay, so this is the West End Blues.
What What was that love?
That was the West End Blues, Louis Armstrong and the Hot Five. And my guest is James Lincoln Collier, author of the new biography, Louis Armstrong, an American Genius. You introduced that as being perhaps one of the most important jazz recordings ever made. What about that recording prompts you to say that?
Well, two things. I think Louis had at this time begun to expand his emotional repertoire. When he first was making the Hot Fives, they tended to be sort of jolly and cheerful. But in 1927, his mother died. He had been very close to his mother. She was a very wayward woman and not at all a responsible parent. But she and Louis were very close. They were almost like brother and sister. She was probably about 15 when Louis was born, so the age difference was minimal, really. And then she died. She came to Chicago to visit him and died there. And you find coming into Louis's work at that time a kind of a deep sadness, a melancholy, which came out in some of his records, such as Tight Like This, and particularly the West End Blues. So there is that kind of deepening of his emotional capacity. Secondly, the record itself works as a unit, as a whole piece. It really has a beginning, middle, and end, and that's very rare in a jazz record where you're so much dependent upon improvisation. But it really seems to hold together as a piece of architecture. And I think because it was so profoundly moving on several levels, the musicians were swept away by it, and they felt that this was the only way to play. If you didn't play like Louis Armstrong, how were you going to play? And so they all began trying to play like Armstrong. They had been doing this already, of course, but this was kind of the capper to the whole thing. And after West End Blues, the people who had been following jazz, the musicians, the jazz fans, and the general public, to the extent that they knew about these kinds of things, realized that jazz had expressive possibilities that were beyond what anybody had thought. It was not just a music to dance to and drink to. It had something special.
What effect did his scatting on that and his other records from this period have on other musicians?
Well, he was probably the first to do much recording of scat singing, but I think that was something that was common that a lot of people had been doing. It wasn't anything particularly new.
How did he begin his collaboration with pianist Earl Hines?
Well, according to Hines, Earl had come up from Pittsburgh and was making a name for himself very quickly around Chicago. And he had come up there in, what, around 23 or 24, and Louis himself was not that well known. And Earl was sitting at the piano in the Black Musicians Union building, Union Hall, playing My Heart Belongs to, I've forgotten what the exact tune was. And Louis came in and unpacked his cornet and started to play along with him. And Earl said, I knew immediately he was a giant. And then they began working together. Louis had been playing with the Oliver Band, but Oliver was a very strong figure, and Louis was a very shy, unself-assertive guy, contrary to what we think of him. He did not want to leave Oliver, but his wife, Lil Armstrong, who was the pianist in the Oliver Band, said, you got to go out on your own, and he did. And then there had been some problems, and so he decided to go back to Oliver, and Earl Hines said, no, you don't want to play that old fogey kind of music. You come on into our band, and he went into the Sunset Cafe, and eventually the band was called Louis Armstrong and his Stompers, and it all went off from there.
When his Hot 5 recordings started to take off, how were they promoted by the record company?
Well, they advertised. The record companies were advertising them. They were particularly advertising them in the black press. These records were originally aimed for a black market. Some of the smaller record companies had discovered that there was a black market there, and OK, which made most of Louis' early records, was deliberately trying to pick up some of that black audience. And so the records were being advertised in the Chicago Defender, which was not merely a Chicago paper, it was a national black paper. And I think when the first song we heard, the one he sings.
The first song that we heard
you're
today?
Right, yes.
We just heard West End Blues, is that what you mean?
No.
Heebie-jeebies,
yes. I don't know why that's gotten away from me. That became kind of a hit for them, and they began giving out pictures of Louis Armstrong in the record stores if you bought a record and so forth. And so they did promote them. They used to hold mammoth jazz concerts in Chicago at the Chicago Coliseum where they'd have 10 or 20,000 people, and they would get the Hot 5 to come and play at those, too.
Well, with that success, just a few years afterwards, you started recording a lot of pop tunes. And I guess that's what a lot of people would consider the beginning of his selling out or becoming showbiz. What do you think of the early pop tunes that he recorded in the late 20s and the 30s? I'm talking about the pre-Hello Dolly era.
Well, there, you know, and you can't knock the kinds of things Louis did because he was always a marvelous singer. He was a great pop singer and it attracted an enormous audience. But it is perfectly true that the quality of his playing, particularly his trumpet playing, went downhill. But in the early days, those early big band records he was still playing wonderful, wonderful jazz. And it's also a pleasure to hear him sing. What was happening to him at that point was he'd got in the hands of some pretty tough managers with gangland connections, and they were trying to pull him out of the black audience and have him, as we'd say today, cross over into the white audience. And so they put him in front of the big bands, which is something the white audience understood better.
Let's listen to one of those big band recordings. And you've suggested that we listen to Ain't Misbehaving. Can you set the context for this?
Sure. Ain't Misbehaving. Louis had come to New York in 1929. The cabaret business had collapsed in Chicago about that time because a reform movement had got in and threw the gangsters out, and they closed a lot of them up. So Louis had come to New York, and he was playing in a show in Connie's Inn, which was one of the big cabarets in Harlem, which were segregated. They were for white audiences only, but they had a black show. These shows were very popular, and at that time, there was a great vogue for black entertainment. There were many, many black shows on Broadway, and in fact, touring the country with black casts, mainly frequently written entirely by blacks. And the show that Louis was playing in at Connie's Inn was called Hot Chocolates, and it was written by Fats Waller. And because it was successful, the people who owned the cabaret moved it down to Broadway. Louis was an unknown figure in New York. He was, of course, known to musicians, but he was unknown to the general public. He started out singing Ain't Misbehavin' from the pit, kind of his reprise during intermission. And so successful was he that by the time the show was over, he was on stage, singing it on stage, and doing acts and doing some playing. And it was at that moment when he broke out and started to become a popular entertainer.
Let's listen to this recording of Ain't Misbehavin'.
Thank you.
myself. No one bought me. I'm happy on a shelf, babe. Ain't misbehaving. Saving my love. Oh, baby, love you. Really, baby, love you. And I know it's saying, one I love. Through it flooding. You that I'm thinking of. Ain't misbehaving. Saving my love. Oh, baby, my love for you. Jackie Horner, in no corner, don't go nowhere, and I don't care, all your kisses weren't waiting for me. Daddy, I don't stay out late, don't care to go, I'm home about me and my radio, babe. Ain't misbehaving, saving all my love for you.
Ain't Misbehavin', Louis Armstrong's 1929 recording. Do you think after the success of his big band sessions that he was pushed into or wanted himself to go into a more commercial direction?
There's no question about it. Both. He was pushed, but he really wanted to go in that direction. It's a very curious thing is that Louis Armstrong, one of our greatest jazz musicians, never really thought of himself as essentially a jazz musician. He was an all-purpose musician. He had come up as a kid, learning to play marches, learning to play all kinds of pop tunes, rags, the blues, everything. He considered he could do anything. When he was playing on the famous riverboats in the 1920, those were dance bands. Those weren't jazz bands. They had jazz musicians in them, and they'd do jazz features, but they were essentially dance bands. When he was playing in the Sunset Cafe in Chicago in the second half of the 1920s, at the time he was making all those wonderful Hot 5 records, he again was playing with a show band. They were playing, they accompanied the dancers, they played for dancing, and then Louis would get up and do a couple of jazz specialties in the course of the evening. So that he never thought of himself as a jazz musician, as an artist. He certainly never thought of himself as an artist. He didn't think of himself as the keeper of some sacred flame. He was an entertainer. He had, and I think that this is the crucial point, because he had been so deprived, abandoned by his father, really, who practically disowned him, in fact, did disown him, left by his mother for periods, raised in a kind of degradation that's almost impossible to believe, never had more than two or three pieces of clothing. He never saw an inside bathroom until he was in his 20s. He never owned a piece of new clothing until he was in his 20s. He never had Christmas. He never had a Christmas tree until he was in his 40s. He didn't have a birthday. He didn't know when he was born. He had nothing. He had as little as it is possible for a human being to have. And this had to leave scars and wounds. He was a wounded, insecure, shy man to the end of his life. At the very end of his life, he still was scared to death that somebody wouldn't like what he was doing. With all the fame that he had. And this inevitably made him hunger for applause. And so when he discovered in the 1920s that he could win audiences, win that applause. People would laugh. People would cheer. People would pack halls where he was playing. There was no way he was going to turn that down. And so he tended then more and more, of course, to go the entertainment route as an entertainer, mugging, singing, prancing around, dancing. He did all kinds of stuff that it's embarrassing to think about today. He used to do a routine with his sidekick, Zooty Singleton, who was also from New Orleans, a drummer. Zooty would dress up in drag, and he was a big guy, and Louis was little, and Zooty would come out and play, put on an act of the angry housewife beating up on her henpecked husband, who was what Louis would play. He did whatever was necessary to make himself get on as an entertainer. These things sound terrible to us today, but they were much more typical of that time, of course.
Well, it's easy now to use words like being commercial, and since jazz is not a top 10 kind of music and doesn't sell like, say, rock and roll records do, we can think of it as an art music. But you point out that when he was beginning to play in the 20s, that jazz was a popular music, and it wasn't a stranger to show business as we think of it now.
No, that's absolutely correct, Terry. He was jazz was very much a part of show business. It was being broadcast. I know for a fact there was more good jazz being played, at least in New York. I can't say about Philadelphia, but in New York there was more good jazz being played in the 1920s than there is today on radio. A lot of it was the very watered down, commercialized jazz, a kind of dance band jazz that the populace accepted as jazz, but a lot of the other stuff was carried along too. The great famous bands, Fletcher Henderson, Duke Ellington, Armstrong, these people were all broadcasting sometimes every night and sometimes twice a night, which means that there was an enormous acceptance at that time for what was really very advanced music.
Some of the bands that he was playing with in the 30s when he was in New York weren't bands under his own direction. And there's a series of recordings with a Hawaiian band that he made. We're going to listen to a selection from it. And I'd very much like to hear your impressions of those records that he made, which I guess I have real affection for, but I know that a lot of people consider them to be very trite and commercial.
Well, what happened here was that in 1935, Louis went with Decca, which was a brand new company, a highly commercial company. They were making records that were made fast, was sold fast, and disappeared. And one of the things they did, this was, of course, the Depression, to give the effect of a bargain, they used to double up some of their stars. So they'd put Louis in with Jimmy Dorsey, or they'd put Louis in with the Mills Brothers, or in these cases, they put Louis in with these with these Hawaiian bands, and that's how these records came to be made. Commercial AR, but Louis was a beautiful singer, and you can't ever knock his singing at all.
Well, let's listen to a 1935 recording that he made with one of the Hawaiian bands, and this is called On a Coconut Island.
On a coconut island, I'd like to be a castaway with you. On a coconut island, there wouldn't be so very much to do. I would linger a while and just gaze into your lovely eyes of blue. Then I'd walk for a mile and come running back to be with you. There, the waves would make a pair of willing slaves of you and me forever. And for days and days and days we'd never gaze out where the ships go sailing by. On a coconut island, I'd like to be a castaway with you. On a coconut island, where we could make our dreams come true. On a coconut island, I'd like to be a castaway with you. Ooh. On a coconut island, there wouldn't be so very much to do. Ooh. I would linger a while and just gaze into your lovely eyes of blue. Then I'd walk for a mile and come running back to be with you. Ooh.
Then the waves would make a pair of willing slaves of you and me forever. And we'd laze for days and days and never gaze out where the ships go sailing by on a coconut island. I'd like to be a castaway with you. Bask in your smile and to realize my dreams come true. Slaves of you and me forever, and for days and days and days we'd never gaze out where the ships go sailing by on Coconut Island. I'd like to be a castaway with you. Coconut Island, baby, we could make our dream come true, baby.
Louis Armstrong's 1936 recording of Coconut Island. And my guest is James Lincoln Collier, who's written a new critical biography of Armstrong. And you were commenting as we were hearing that sometimes his trumpet playing was actually better with pop bands like this. Why do you think that was?
Well, when he got put in with a group like this or with the Mills Brothers, he couldn't get into the high note bravura showboating kind of thing that he had such a weakness for, which he found it was very effective with audiences. He was forced to play quietly, and he was also forced away from the melody because somebody else was dealing with the melody. And he quite often produced the tiny little gems, such as the solo we just heard. Of course, you have to listen to that with this steel guitar going over top of that Hawaiian guitar going over top of it. But it was beautiful, a little beautiful little bit that he played in there.
Something that a lot of his listeners will never really forgive him for is the kind of timing that he did on stage. How did he develop that persona, and what do you know about his attitude towards racial politics?
Well, what we have to understand first is that beginning in the 1880s or 1890s, blacks had discovered they could get into show business through the minstrel show route, and they developed a tradition of the black playing that black stereotype, the happy-go-lucky singer with the dancing feet and the love for watermelon and chicken and razor blades and all that kind of thing. It was really the only way they could go. You could not present yourself as a serious popular singer if you were black in the 1920s and even into the 1930s. So Louis had no choice. It was really the only way he was going to be able to work for a white audience was with this kind of that terrible Uncle Tom stereotype. The complaint has been leveled at him, of course, that he carried on with it far too long, that he was continuing to do it after it wasn't necessary. All you can say about that is it was his training. It was what he had done. It had worked for him with audiences, and he just wasn't eager to give it up. But eventually, of course, he did.
Do you think the show business aspect of his career prevented him from fulfilling his own potential as a musician?
Well, I mean, sure, this guy was a genius. He was one of the great geniuses we've had in America in 20th century music. And there, you just weep to think of the possibility. Suppose he had, say, a Duke Ellington scoring for him and working out things for him. It would have been unbelievable, but that was not his choice, and it's not our business to say that it should have been.
Well, I regret to say that we're about out of time. What I'd like to do is to conclude this segment by hearing two records back-to-back. A very popular one. It was a big hit in, I guess, the 60s, his recording of Mac the Knife that I'm sure our listeners will remember, and the other, his recording of Sweethearts on Parade. Can you talk about both of them and compare his approach in both these recordings that we'll hear?
Well, Mac the Knife was a big hit for it, and I think the listener should note that he plays a trumpet behind one of his own vocal choruses on it. It was the kind of thing that he did so well, not great jazz, but just beautiful popular singing. When we talk about Sweethearts on Parade, which is one of my special favorites, this was a tune, a very corny pop tune written by Carmen Lombardo. Louis recorded it in the very early 30s. And this record shows you that he could take the worst kind of sentimental material and make something absolutely beautiful out of it. He has placed two trumpet solos on this thing, and they're both absolutely superb.
And Sweethearts on Parade is from the early 30s? Like
1930, I believe, yes.
Okay, and Mack the Knife is from somewhere in the 1960s. I don't remember
right.
The
Right. What year was that? No, it was the late 50s.
Was it that early?
I think it was 58 or 59, but I would have to check that.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for having been here with us.
Well,
thanks
Terry, thanks
here.
Very
it.
Much for having me.
My guest has been James Lincoln Collier, whose new book is a biography of Armstrong. It's called Louis Armstrong, an American Genius, and it's just been published by Oxford. And we're going to hear now the two records that James Lincoln Collier was just referring to, Mack the Knife and then Sweethearts on Parade.
Dig, man, there goes Mack the Knife. Shark has pretty teeth, dear, and he shows them a pearly white. Just a jackknife has Mack Heat, dear, and he keeps it out of sight. When the shark bites with his teeth, dear, scarlet billows start to spread. Fancy gloves, though, wears Mack Heat, dear, so there's not a trace of red. On the sidewalk, Sunday morning, baby, lies a body oozing light. Someone sneaking around the corner. Is this someone, Mack the Knife, from a tugboat by the river? A cement bag's drooping down. Yes, the cement's just for the weight, dear. Bet you Mack he's back in town. Look a year, Louis Miller disappeared, dear, after drawing out his cash. And Mack Heat spends like a sailor. Did our boy do something rash? Suki Tawdry, Jenny Diver, Lottie Lanier, Sweet Lucy Brown. Oh, the line forms on the right, dears. Now that Mack Heat's back in town.
Take it, Satch.
Thank you.
go marching through, baby. All the sweethearts on parade, parade, parade. Can't help crying as they pass me by. All the sweethearts hearts on parade, for parade. I'd love to join the fun, but they bore me very more. It takes more than one to join the army. Love, and how I find as they fall in line. Oh, the sweetheart long parade.
So, Sweethearts on Parade, Louis Armstrong's 1930 recording, and we opened that set with his recording of Mack the Knife. And prior to those two recordings, we heard from James Lincoln Collier,